Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. An organization in Kansas City, Kansas is helping potential border kids in Latin America stay in their home countries. We'll talk with a member of Unbound later on this hour about the very difficult task its workers face. But first today, a very familiar public official is with us. Former Kansas City Mayor Kay Barnes joins me in the studio to talk about a man who once ruled Kansas City very differently from how she once ran it. And I'm talking about boss Tom Pender. Guest. Mayor Barnes is giving a talk at the library on Sunday that focuses on reform-minded women who did a lot to finally bring down the corrupt reign of Tom Pendergast. Kay Barnes was the first woman to win a mayor's race in Kansas City, and she served two terms beginning in 1999. And Mayor, welcome back. It's been too long.
Thank you. Great to be here with you.
Well, people are going to wonder, what are you doing these days?
I am on the graduate faculty at Park University, yes, the School of Public Affairs, mm-hmm, and teach a course on leadership in addition to doing some other programming with the Center for Leadership there, which I started several years ago. And I'm doing some other things in the community, serving on boards. So I'm having a good time. It's a good pace. And it's great to be involved in those ways.
Do you miss the 1,000 mile per hour pace of your days when you were mayor?
I don't know that I miss totally that pace. I do miss a lot of being mayor. It was a wonderful experience. So I would say unique, and I loved it.
Has it been hard for you to step back and not be as engaged in the issues of the day as you once were?
Well, in one way, it's not been difficult because I don't bear the responsibility. Yeah. So it's easy to turn my back a few days on some of the issues. On the other hand, obviously, I'm very interested, very supportive. I think Sly James is a terrific mayor, so I'm very supportive of his efforts and am happy to see all of the progress the city is still making.
You know, when you stepped away from the mayor's office, you know, is there a sense of sort of a load coming off your back, a responsibility that you, I'm sure you bore every day to one degree or another, right?
Yes, I think there is a load that comes off of your back related to that level of responsibility. And also, when you're in the mayor's office, it is amazing how every single day there are unexpected occurrences you have to deal with. Some of them are positive. Many of them are more negative. So not having to anticipate the unknown every single day is certainly a relief. But as I said, a lot of the rest of the experience I miss.
Well, you've been in the news lately, and it's been all good. No controversy for once here. But one of your successors, again, Mayor James, wants to find an appropriate way to honor you for your years of service to the city and the revitalization of downtown Kansas City. He's even appointed a task force to figure out the right way to do all this. What do you make of it?
Well, I appreciate the gesture. Mm-hmm. I really do. I have never given a lot of thought to that kind of effort, so it's a little embarrassing.
Yes.
And yet, again, I know the people involved are very interested in doing the right thing, and I appreciate their interest.
Well, I asked some folks on my Facebook page what would be the appropriate way to honor former Kansas City Mayor Kay Barnes. We got some great answers. Sharon Kelly wrote this, rename the Broadway Bridge. There's one idea. Steph Guerin said, K-Day, a great day of volunteering all across the city where we do, we all do a little bit to give back in a big way.
That's a great idea.
Nice idea, I thought.
It really is.
Jeff Megalith said, you could rename Carnes Boulevard cheaply by squeezing in three more letters for Kay Barnes.
Very creative.
Joyce Parker says, Kay Barnes International Airport.
Oh, my.
Not bad. KBIA instead of KCI, I guess. D. Roshan Gilmore writes this, Barnes Kansas City International Airport has a nice ring to it. Tell her I said so. Roy Inman said a statue of her on that empty pedestal in front of Union Station.
Oh, my.
One more. Wade Sisson said, put a big K statue between the two barns down in the American Royal area and call them the K Barns.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
A lot of creativity comes across there.
Not bad, eh? But you're here to talk about something else, and that's the women of Kansas City who came together once upon a time to help knock Tom Pendergast out of power. And this was back in the 1940 city elections. How did you get interested in something like this?
I decided about a year and a half ago that because I like to continue to learn, I wanted to take some courses. So I started with a course at KU with a terrific professor there. And part of my assignment was to prepare a rather lengthy research paper on a topic having to do with Kansas City. So I did choose the 1940 election, which was a pivotal one.
Maybe the most pivotal one.
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. One in which women played a very important role. I didn't know a lot about it, and I still have a lot to learn, but based on the research that I was able to do, I put together a paper that does primarily focus on what happened in the 1930s, which led to the need for the level of reform that then occurred in 1940.
And how did you even become aware that women had played such a key role in that election?
I think primarily from anecdotes in the community, older people telling me, you know, I lived through that election, or I was a child and my mother was really involved, and then some reading that I had done periodically.
You know, as someone who sat in the power seat at City Hall, Kay, how hard is it for you to imagine someone, you know, someone like Tom Pendergast amassing so much power?
It's hard to imagine. It really is, because the level of control he exerted, the amount of corruption that was there, the police department, for example, which is so radically different from the climate that we now have, not only in the police department, but throughout the community. It was a radical kind of environment in Kansas City during the 1930s that was wild and crazy.
And it was all sort of set up by the fact the country was going through this incredible depression, which sort of set the stage for Tom Pendergast to do what he wound up doing.
Well, yes. And what's interesting is that there were some elements of what was allowed to occur in Kansas City that contributed to the economy, as far as people coming here sometimes from all over the country to experience all of the bars and the prostitution and all that was going on here. So it was kind of a double-edged sword for a period of time, but it all fell apart eventually.
You know, I've always wanted to go to Tom Pendergast's office. It was at 1911, something like that, on Main Street there. And I've been by the building a million times, and I've looked through the window at the steps going up, and I just wanted to see his office where he did what he did. I think it's still there.
I think it is. I don't know whether there's been an effort to maintain it as it was. Certainly the building is still there.
Yeah. Okay, so the 1940 election comes along, and people begin to galvanize, and what begins to happen in Kansas City?
Well, certainly, as things became even more challenging, there became a recognition that there was a lot of fear within the citizenry. The city hall and city government began to have this deficit, which turned out after the 1940 election to total up to $11 million.
A lot of money in those days.
A huge amount of money. And in fact, my cousin, Walter Cronkite, has always loved to tell the story about when he was a Cub reporter in Kansas City during the mid to late 1930s. He had only been in Kansas City a few weeks working for one of the local newspapers, not the Kansas City Star. It was another one. So it was the local election day, and he wanted to be sure to vote. So before he went into his office and the press room, he did vote. So he then went to work, and he'd been in the press room for about half an hour, and his boss came up to him and said, "Walter, we need you to go vote." And Walter said, "Well, I already voted." And his boss said, "Well, we need you to vote again." And Walter didn't want to lose his brand new job. So he hesitantly said, okay, and his boss handed him a little sheet of paper with a name on it, and he said, if you'll go outside, there'll be a police officer there, and he will take you in a police car to a different polling place.
Oh my gosh.
And use this name and vote. So Walder did, came back to the press room. He'd been there about an hour, and his boss came up to him again and said, Walder, we need you to go vote. And Walder said, well, I've already voted twice. And he said, well, we need you to vote again. Handed him another sheet of paper with a different name and said, go outside. There'll be a different police officer, and he will take you in the police car to a different polling place to vote. So on that particular day, Walder voted three times, and he, as I said, loved to tell the story to his friends from around the country, and they were all shocked that Walter Cronkite would vote three times in one election.
And this was in 36 or 32, or do you have any feel for that?
I'm not sure which election.
But it was one of the Pendergast
elections. Yes, it was very much one of the Pendergast elections.
We're visiting with former Kansas City Mayor Kay Barnes. You know, these women who began to mobilize against Pendergast, how big of a risk were they taking?
I think many of them viewed it as a considerable risk, particularly if they were married to men who had businesses in the community. There were doctors, lawyers, businessmen, and so on who were certainly under the thumb, so to speak, of Pendergast and had received threats. There was a woman, Edith Dalby, for example, who was the wife of a minister at Broadway Baptist Church, who began to speak out, and her family was threatened. And in fact, it became so bad as she was criticizing Pendergast that the family had to leave Kansas City for several months just to avoid what the recriminations appeared to be. So that was just one example. I think what made a difference was that the corruption became so apparent, and also evidence that Pendergast was going to go down in terms of being indicted, and then the work that the U.S. federal courts began to do, and so on. There were a series of episodes that more and more women decided, we absolutely have to take a stand, and now is the time to do it. There were obviously a lot of civic leaders, men, who were also doing the same, but what ended up happening was that for both elections in 1940, February 13th and April 4th, literally thousands of women were involved in the campaigns, and they were the ones who really did a lot of the hard work that you and I know has to go into a successful campaign.
Grassroots organizing you're talking
yes,
about.
That's
calling
right.
people up, getting them to the polls, doing what you need to do.
Yes, that's right.
And they did it why? What was the galvanizing sense? Just this overwhelming sense of corruption, or what was it that drove them so hard?
One of the events that occurred that I think symbolized to the women that this was not all about men was that the presiding judge in Jackson County, who was an anti-machine person, appointed three women, female leaders in the community, including Mrs. Charles Seidlitz, to do an audit, an informal audit, of some of the county departments. They agreed to do it. They took it on. They volunteered. They spent months just working diligently on doing this assessment. And the two other Jackson County judges, who were both machine judges, decided they were getting too close to some of the real issues that were going on.
Wow.
And took them out of that role, said, we no longer need you, and they were, in a sense, fired, if you can fire volunteers. There was a lot of outrage in the overall community about that action, and I think a lot of women saw these three women have this occur, decided, well, this isn't just about the guys. This is now affecting us.
Mm-hmm. How do the women finally organize themselves, Mayor? What did they do to sort of pull themselves together and begin to work cooperatively to make a difference here?
Well, there were certainly women's organizations, two primary ones being Athenaeum at that time, the Women's City Club, certainly the League of Women Voters. Those organizations began to join with some of the more political organizations, the Republicans, and also some Democratic good government groups. And finally, they all formed together United Campaign Committee. Then that United Campaign Committee had a women's division. The key woman in the entire set of campaigns was Mrs. George Gorton, G-O-R-T-O-N. Her first name was Claude. Claude Gorton was a dynamic leader. She was the one whom a lot of people credit with having made everything happen. She was a terrific organizer, worked night and day for months, went out and spoke in every part of the community. So she was terrific.
Is she remembered very much today?
She's certainly remembered in some circles. Jane Flynn, in her book on Kansas City women, highlighted the work of Claude Gorton. And as one veteran reporter commented 25 years later, when the Citizens Association was honoring her, that if she had been a man, she would have become president. She was that dynamic and that skilled.
Former Mayor Kay Barnes is our guest. We're talking about the 1940 Kansas City election that turned in part because so many women galvanized to kick out the Pendergast machine, the corrupt Pendergast machine. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888 is our number here. Again, 816-235-2888. And I should point out that Mayor Barnes will be speaking at 2 o'clock on Sunday afternoon at the Central Library of the Kansas City Public Library, the branch at 14 West 10th Street. The topic, Civic Housekeepers, Kansas City Women versus Tom Pendergast. To RSVP, go to kclibrary.org. You know, Kay, what were the women able to accomplish that men couldn't in bringing attention to what was going on? Is it just as simple as a notion that in those days, most of the men were working and many women were not and had time to organize and deal with this? Or does it go beyond that?
Well, I think it was a combination. Certainly, there were many men who were employed and were not able to be engaged in the campaign day in, day out, and certainly on election day. On the other hand, I think women at that time had an enormous amount of perhaps unexpressed energy and leadership potential. So
the world was starting to change.
Yes, that's right. And I had a quote that I think illustrates the response to the question that you were asking. One of the men on the April election day said, "The men were doing nothing in the 11th precinct of the 7th ward. The women were getting out darn near the whole vote, and it's a good big vote, too." Another man said that he had 17 women just in his precinct driving cars, telephoning, and passing out cards to procrastinators. And then one other said there were 12 women doing their bit, and they've been up since dawn telephoning and driving, and they don't even stop to eat. I've watched them. I don't know if one of them that's taken off for lunch. So that's illustrative of the level of energy.
The commitment was extraordinary, it sounds like.
Yes, it was.
And go ahead. I'm sorry.
I think, too, whether we're talking about men or women, that when there is a common cause that people really believe in that is so important, and they're part of this larger group all focused on the same goal, that a lot of good things happen.
Hey, and were these women mostly in the more affluent parts of town, or were they from everywhere?
They were from everywhere. Much of the leadership did come from what was then referred to as the South Side, which was probably 31st Street South.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that it, though, was illustrative of all kinds of women coming together to the degree possible. Some of the women who were less economically in good shape were probably either working themselves or really didn't have the wherewithal to be as involved. every indication I have had in the research I've done is that it was as inclusive as was feasible at that time.
Mayor, if you'll just hold those headphones up to your ear, I'm going to grab a phone call here from Catherine at 816-235-2888. Catherine from Kansas City, Missouri, you're on with Mayor Kay Barnes. Good morning.
Oh, what an honor. Mayor Barnes, this is Catherine Singleton, and it's so great to hear your voice, and this is such an exciting story that you're telling. I have a couple of questions, and there have been one of my cousins mentioned that our grandparents were involved in this effort, and I'm wondering what kind of documentation exists about the folks who actually were part of this effort.
Well, thank you for your comment and also your question. There is quite a bit of documentation, although most of it is are copies of newspaper articles. There were two or three newspapers at that time, the Star certainly being a primary one. And the Kansas City Star, by the way, was very, very supportive of this reform effort. So there are multiple scrapbooks available in the Missouri Valley Room. There are some commentaries that have been written by individuals. There are some oral history tapes that are available through the both Jackson County and the Missouri Historical Society. So there certainly is enough material available to do what I would call adequate research. Obviously, as we look back now, I'm sure we would all wish that we had even more documentation.
Yeah. Yeah.
But certainly the anecdotes that have been shared by older family members, both deceased and living, are really important.
Sure. Well, I'll be asking my dad and uncles, but and my aunt. But I thought, you know, if there was something in writing that you know, people's memories are
right.
Not always. They were all pretty young at the time.
Well, yeah. The Missouri Valley Room at the Downtown Public Library is probably the best place to start. And what they do not have access to, they will refer you to the Jackson County Historical Society, the Missouri Historical Society, and any other resources.
Catherine, thank you. And I guess, Kay, to wrap this up, the result in the 1940 election was what? What happened on Election Day?
Election Day on February 13th enabled the citizenry to vote to reduce the terms of office from 4 to 2 years, which then opened the door for the April 4th election for the election of John Gage as mayor, reform mayor, and all but one council members as reform members.
Wow.
So that was a 180-degree turn for this city, and I think we have been reaping the benefits ever since.
Again, Mayor Barnes will be speaking at 2 o'clock on Sunday at the Central Branch of the Kansas City Public Library, 14 West 10th Street. To RSVP and to get some more information, go to kclibrary.org. Mayor, always good to have you here. So good to visit.
Great to be with
you.
Keep
going, okay?